This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, healthy eating for the summer with Rick Guillen. But first, we just had Father's Day, a time to celebrate what it means to be a dad, what it means to be a man. And there is a new book out that explores how to grow from a boy into a man, specifically an Ojibwe man. Dr. Anton Troyer has written extensively about Ojibwe life. He is a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University, and he's written books about his culture, like The Cultural Toolbox, Traditional Ojibwe Living in the Modern World, and Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians, But Were Afraid to Ask. He's now out with his first novel, Where Wolves Don't Die. The book explores masculinity, living with nature, family secrets, and race relations. Dr. Troyer Migwich, thanks for being on Main Street with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why did you want to write a novel after the many other books and scholarly papers you've published?
You know, this has been such a fun and fascinating effort for me. I've been telling stories my whole life, from my childhood, being brought to and participating in Ojibwe storytelling events, the banter around the kitchen table coming from a very large family. And then, you know, in my professional and ceremonial work, I am always telling stories. In fact, even when writing nonfiction work, you're still telling stories.
Yeah.
But fiction was a whole new effort for me. And in some ways, I found it very liberating. And in other ways, I found new challenges, and I really, really enjoyed the process for putting Where Wolves Don't Die together. And I'm super excited about the book now that it's coming out into the world.
How do you describe the book?
You know, this is a young adult novel, and it is both a taut thriller and also a tender coming-of-age story about a 15-year-old Native kid who gets into trouble in Minneapolis and gets sent to the family's equivalent of juvie to go run a trap line with his grandfather in the Canadian wilderness. And, you know, he is stumbling into a path of self-discovery and learning more and more deeply about his own culture, connections to his family. It's a very heartful tale, but at the same time, it is a thriller. There's a whodunit and lots of tension in the story. And so I have lots of children myself. My youngest ones are aged 12, 14, and 17. And I read it out loud to them in sections when I was writing it. And I was just so pumped about their response to the work, because they kept saying, well, read the next one. Well, what happened next? Do you think it could be this? Do you think it could be that? And, you know, so that was like, you know, that is the most discerning audience there is, a father
yeah,
to his teenage children.
Kids do not mince words when they don't like something.
Right. They would just be like, whatever, scrolling in their phone or something. But, but that is not what happened. So I was like, this is really good. And then the other things, you know, I'm trying to do a lot of things with this book. Like, for one, most of the literature about Native people until quite recently had been written by non-Native people.
Right.
Certainly the genre has turned, and there are lots of emerging Indigenous authors now. But a lot of the literature, even the more recent stuff, you know, speak to the Native experience with poverty, trauma, tragedy, and have characters who lament a culture that they never got to receive because residential boarding schools and things like that. And while this work is unflinching in its look at those tough things, it's really an entirely different story. And instead of imagining Indigenous culture or lamenting its absence, I wanted to give people a chance to see native culture. It's a window in. Yeah. And, you know, the protagonist, this boy named Ezra, you know, goes through these experiences of like his first successful, you know, animal harvest and things like that. And it just provides an opportunity to connect people to the culture that I know and live and have been teaching to my children in a way that's real and authentic and relatable, but also in a story that's engaging and full of tension and excitement. You know, so I'm really excited about, you know, that effort. And there's another dimension to this too that I'm trying to do, which is that, you know, I think in recent years we have had, you know, efforts to broaden the array of voices in literature. So we have more female authors, we have, you know, the beginning of more voices across gender identities who are producing really great work in the field, all of which is really welcome. And in addition to that, there's been an effort to kind of tackle the patriarchy by examining toxic masculinity and things like that. But something that hasn't been done as much and hasn't been done as much very well is an exploration of what would it look like for a boy to become a man in a healthy way.
Yeah.
In its own cultural context. So not, you know, a dismantling of the toxic masculinity, but a rebuilding of positive, healthy coming of age. And this story definitely does that. And I'm really excited about what it can do for shaping or reshaping perspectives of Native culture, adulthood, and lots of things.
We're visiting today with Dr. Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe by day and now novelist, in addition to many other books that he has written that are a little bit more scholarly in approach. And you can find out more at antontroyer.com, and Troyer spelled T-R-E-U-E-R. And what you just said about toxic masculinity, there's a really beautiful passage in the book after Ezra has his first big hunt and a time when he is navigating being a boy and into a man. I'd love it if you could share where Ezra's dad and grandpa are teaching him what it means to be a hunter and provide for your community. And it starts with his dad dipping the spoon into the moose meat and offering Ezra meat from his first kill.
Gwis. Gawin, in the name of Agabinujia Gayansigwa Gegu, Jimijiwad. No, I said, following his instructions. I'm thinking of children who don't have enough to eat. There were a few murmurs and nods among the men sitting next to Grandpa Liam. Gwis. Gawin. In denenema gichia ya'a gashkitusigwa jibamia dizawad. No, I'm thinking of my elders who can't get out into the woods to hunt for themselves. There was more nodding. I could feel all eyes on me as my dad pulled the spoon back and offered it to me a third time. Gwis. Gawin, indenenamag indinawemag anug, nijanishanabig, minawa gapejajig, jiwidu kawiwad. No, I'm thinking of my family, my community, and people who came here today to support me. He pulled the spoon back and offered it to me a fourth time. Gwis. He nodded, and I opened my mouth and took the meat, chewing slowly, and aware of every set of eyes in the building still fixed on me. My dad returned to his seat, and Grandpa Liam started to speak again. Ezra, you just changed your life. Up until today, you were what we called a dependent. You depended on all of the people in this room to provide all of your food. My gaze shifted around the room from Daniel Drumbeater to the George family to my grandparents and my dad. Grandpa Liam continued, but today you are providing for all of us. This is what it means to be an adult. From today on, you will have a special power. It's the power to gather resources. You'll have it when you hunt and trap, when you fish, when you pick berries, and when you get a job. Use your power to think of children in need, elders who can't get it for themselves, your family, and community.
Anton, what does it mean to you to be a man?
You know, this is something I think about a lot. Both in recent years, I've lost both of my parents and have raised 9 children. And I'm now in the grandbaby business. We have 4 grandchildren.
Congrats.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, I think about, you know, what my parents gave to me, what I hope to give to my children and grandchildren. And to me, this passage speaks to that. I went through a first kill feast the first time I had a successful harvest. We've done these ceremonies with all of the boys and girls in our family as they become successful harvesters. And it's really an impactful ceremony. One of my sons, his name's Isaac, he had really been moved by this ceremony. And it seemed like every time he'd even get a rabbit, he'd be calling my mom and she'd say, come on over here, I'm cooking for you. And I remember one time I had a friend complaining, oh, my back, I can't get out in the woods. And he didn't say anything, but he went out in the woods. He's about 16 then, harvested a deer, cleaned it up, packaged it up. And he went over to my friend's house and filled up his freezer. And then he left. And my friend calls.
Oh, I just got the chills.
Yeah. And so my friend calls and he's like, what an incredible young man. I didn't even know anybody remembered these teachings. Can I give him some gifts? Well, I said, of course. And then the same kid, a couple years later, he and his buddy were going to double date to the high school prom. So I got him set up with a tux. And his friend's mom said, oh, my next check, you know, I'll get you the tux, I promise. And then her car went down and she had to say, I'm so sorry, but I can't. So he was all heartbroken, ready to cancel his prom date. My son said, oh, forget that. Come on, let's go. They went to the tux place. My son canceled his tux. He took the money. They went to the Goodwill. They bought a couple suits and everybody went to the prom. And I remember showing up at the prom to take pictures. And I'm like, where'd that tux go that I rented you? You know, and then he said, but, you know, you should have told me. I said, I would have rented the kid a tux. And he looked at me just quizzically and said, but Dad, it's my job to look out for people who don't have enough. And so it just kind of reminded me that
your son is real.
That's a real human. Yeah.
Wow.
And like what's in that cultural practice, sure, it reflects our values as a people, but it shapes our values too. And I guess that's one of the things I was trying to do with Where Wolves Don't Die is give people a window into some of the Ojibwe culture that shapes those things. And how that manifests in someone's growing and maturing and becoming an adult.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Our conversation today with Dr. Anton Troyer about his novel, Where Wolves Don't Die. Coming up after this break, we visit about wolves, how they structure their lives, and how that influences how his people organize family structure.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
And we're back on Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg. We're visiting today with professor and writer Dr. Anton Troyer about his first novel, Where Wolves Don't Die. Protagonist Ezra Cloud is a young Ojibwe teen who runs into trouble in school while defending a friend from an attack by a white teenager. Ezra is sent to work the traplines way in North Canada, among the ancestral homelands of the Anishinaabe people. He's part of the Wolf Clan, and while immersed in wild nature, he learns about what it means to be a man by studying how wolves interact. There's a passage in the book about how they hunt together, they raise their pups together, they're stronger in a pack, and the alpha male doesn't typically fight with the other males to establish dominance. He does this by having more and then providing more. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how your background informs this idea of being a part of nature rather than better than nature.
Right. And, you know, this is like within literature, it's a delicate thing. I think Native people get fetishized and exoticized, with regard to things in the wild. But at the same time, we have a clan system, and the clans are animals, birds, or fish, and they double as a symbol for your family and a spiritual guide. And so, you know, Ezra is of the Wolf Clan. And so this is, you know, part of his awakening happens, you know, introspectively as he understands himself. And part of it is happening as he is outward facing and connecting with his family members, but also with the natural world. And I think, I spend a lot of my time outdoors. And it has been through these practices, things like fasting, hunting, and so forth, that I've deepened my understanding and connection to those things. And so I wanted to provide a way for people to, you know, relate to that experience. And even, you know, although it's a subtext, you know, within the broader piece, what does it mean to be Indigenous? And, you know, a dictionary definition will tell you something like, to be of the land, you know, and someone who is of the land can still be of the land, even if they're off visiting Prague or something like that. But, you know, those connections do need to be fed and nurtured. And so Ezra starts his journey in Minneapolis, and he's in a city and he's hating the dirty snow and wishing for a chance to be with his family and in his place. But as he gets there, it's not exactly what he expected, and it's transformative.
As he is learning how to hunt and be in what you called the family's version of juvie, going and work in a trap line, he does encounter some very dangerous animals. And I think tied into this sort of fetishizing Indigenous people, or I think what Louise Erdrich has called like indigenophilia, is this idea that we're trying to make you all like, oh, you're at one with nature and all of these things, and you're all magical. But you talk in the book a lot about, yes, nature is sacred. It's also trying to kill you.
Right.
Are those two at odds?
Well, it's an irony, just as it is with every human being. You know, sometimes it's uncomfortable when everyone's looking at us, and sometimes we want to be seen. And, you know, I think, you know, within the Native experience, there's a great TED talk called The Danger of a Single Story, which says that among the other things that it shares is that the problem with stereotypes is not so much that they're incorrect as much as they're incomplete. And they leave you with one story to understand a whole complex person or a whole complex group of people. So for Indigenous people, yes, there is a connection to place, to the water, you know, and for Northern Minnesota and Canada, you know, where this book is set, you know, to the water, the woods, you know, animals and so forth. But at the same time, that's not the only thing that's happening there. You know, Grandpa Liam is teaching Ezra how to trap, how to harvest those things, not just only live in perfect harmony. Although I think you would say trapping and living in harmony are not mutually exclusive. Hmm. You know, but at the same time, you know, it is a harsh world that they live in. And, you know, sometimes there are dramatic experiences, you know, when a fisher attacks Ezra, you know, and there's a fight to the death, you know, that ensues. And so it's not only hugs and harmony, there's also contest and, you know, an evaluation of what is our place in the natural world. And I do think there's an indigenous frame and context for that that is a little different than you would hear, you know, in many other cultures. You know, even in Ojibwe artwork, we have a lot of floral designs because in our creation story, you know, all of the growing things were placed here first, and then the four-legged animals and the flying creatures and the swimmers and last of all humans. And if we were to perish from the earth, everything made before us would get by just fine. But if anything made before us were to perish, well, surely we would too. Wow. And so there's this sense of respect and reciprocity that no one can tread upon the earth without taking something, but that when we take, we should be giving back. And, you know, those kind of philosophical concepts are built in through the practice and the culture that is exhibited, you know, and just lived by the characters in the work. But at the same time, it's not just a in the clouds philosophical, you know, imagining. There's also this harsh realities of the world, yeah. The losses that Ezra, you know, has endured, you know, prior to the start of the novel and endures through them, the experiences that other members of the family have had, and they're coming to terms with, you know, the unfairness of the world and the harshness of the natural world, kind of like the wolves that Ezra has affinity to are in a fight for their own survival, and they take lives, but they also nurture life. And this is, yes, a paradox, but it's also one that we all live, regardless of how we face it.
Author Dr. Anton Troyer about his novel, Where Wolves Don't Die. Still to come in our conversation, the raw power of teenage emotion. That's after this.
If you really want to know what's going on in this country ahead of the election next year, you've got to get away from the extremes and listen to the middle.
Hi, my name is Venkat. I'm calling you from Atlanta, Georgia.
On my new live national call-in show, The Middle with Jeremy Hobson, we'll elevate the voices of Americans who need to be part of our national conversation.
Hi, Jan, here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Join me every week for The Middle with Jeremy Hobson.
The Middle. Listen Fridays at 3 p.m. Central, 2 Mountain on Prairie Public.
We're back on Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg with Dr. Anton Troyer, professor by day. He's devoted his life to keeping alive the cultural practices of the Anishinaabe people groups, specifically the Ojibwe. He typically writes nonfiction books like Warrior Nation, A History of the Red Lake Ojibwe. His latest book is a novel, Where Wolves Don't Die. It's an exploration of masculinity, race relations, forces of nature, and human nature. Anton, we've been talking about so much of the book in the context of the natural world, and there is also a couple of teenage boys in
yes.
this book, and there is a white kid who is extremely aggressive and racist and picks on Ezra and Ezra's love interest for seemingly no other reason than they are indigenous. And I'm drawn to two passages in the book, one where Ezra is fighting with this fisher, and he slows down and watches the pattern of the attack, the feint, the hiss, the lunge, retreat, repeat. And that's how he learns to go after this animal acting in the wild. And then when he's up against this other guy who wants to fight him, he might have been stronger than me. He might have been faster. But I had watched a lot more UFC. I was reckless and I was foolish. So there is this going back and forth here between training and intuition, but also raw emotion when two teenage boys come head to head.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, both maybe your experience as having once been a teenage boy and then clearly raising a number of teenage boys and how they're interacting in this world.
Yes, you know, even when we were talking about the first kill ceremony that comes across in the book. There's a section afterwards where they're saying, you know, moose don't usually attack people, but when one does, it's usually not a calf or a big mature antlered, you know, bull. It's usually a young one, a young bull. And they're also the ones that are most likely to get shot or even hit by a car. And it's kind of like providing a metaphor for manhood, that we make a lot of our biggest mistakes when we're young. And, you know, there's guidance, like if you want to be a big mature antlered buck, you know, bull, you got to act like one and move a little slower and think before you do. And so like he has these experiences, both, you know, from watching UFC, from, you know, or Naruto and whatnot. But also, you know, his experience in coaching and his direct experiences, you know, learning with his grandpa Liam in the wild, you know, running the trap line, you know, and so forth. And it does come to a head, of course, in his confrontation, or when he's confronted by this kid, Matt, who he's had a number of altercations with. And so, you know, I think ultimately for an adult, this is part of what we have to learn how to grapple with. Like, it's okay to have feelings, and it's okay to use the energy from your feelings, be it happy, positive energy or anger, and apply it in a positive or constructive way. So you can take it out on the woodpile, you know, as opposed to the person sitting next to you. We do have to be physical as well as, you know, intellectual and emotional in our relationships, but it's learning how to balance those, you know, that navigating our emotions. We don't just want to be, you know, a mindless heart, you know, that is just governed by our emotions only. And we don't want to be a heartless mind that's just Machiavellian, you know, and calculating. And so this is something that Ezra is grappling with, you know, in his journey and in his confrontations with Matt. And something that, you know I have had to grapple with. I, you know, certainly have been emotionally reactive, and just getting older doesn't mean that you immediately grow out of it. It's something you have to work at. And watching my own kids, you know, having to deal with those things, it's painful to watch, and you can't just helicopter and rescue your kids. They have to learn their own way. And, you know, as a parent, you try to provide healthy opportunities and outlets where they can learn that, you know, in an environment that's not going to get them in danger or in some sort of horrible trouble. But at the same time, you know, life will teach the lessons whether you do that intentionally or not.
Ezra, so much of his journey is being that young bull moose and growing into the antlered creature that his dad and his grandpa have become. And there's a passage in the book here from Grandpa Liam talking about bacon. And so much of the book does explore race relations, and he calls it one of the white man's great gifts to the world. And it goes perfectly with one of our gifts, wild rice, bacon and wild rice. And he takes this as a sign that the Great Spirit is telling that there is hope in this world, and someday we'll all get along if we pay attention to the signs. Is that
exactly?
Is that noble or naive to believe?
You know, it's a little bit of both.
I love
really.
That.
I do think, as human beings, all of us from all backgrounds, we want the same things.
Yeah.
We want our children to have a decent chance at a long, healthy, happy life. You know, I think about my father. He wanted me to be better than him. I don't know how many people one encounters in their own life who want you to be better than them. But I certainly felt that with my dad. I certainly feel that about my kids. You know, and it's something very special, sacred even. And so, you know, when I think about race relations and things that are, you know, spoken of, you know, just through experience and conversation, like that passage about the bacon, you know, I don't think it's entirely naive for us to move towards greater alignment, support, and understanding. Mm. I mean, it's really what education's about. It's what a good book is all about. It's what doing things in mixed company and connecting with one another, even on a radio program, is really all about, is helping us understand one another better, to, you know, not just imagine, but understand, and then also empathize with one another. Because when you know someone, then you engage with it and you care about it. And it's only in the not knowing, or the imagining, or the layers of disconnection, objectification from someone or something or a whole group of people, that it becomes possible to wish its destruction. So, you know, I do think, you know, Grandpa Liam was onto something there. And at the same time, the problems don't just go away on their own. We do have to be intentional about thinking about them, acting upon them, orchestrating positive and meaningful change. But I've met so many people who really care and are really trying to do that. So I'm really excited.
Hmm. In the book, it talks about Byron, Ezra's dad, that this is a dream come true for him. Ezra realizes that Ezra working mm-hmm. on the trapline with Grandpa Liam is also a dream come true for Byron, and to feel what he felt and to pass that on. Anton, I can't help but notice, you know, there's a young bull male in the book mm-hmm. and that Byron is a professor teaching his language, which is what you do.
Right.
And one of your first answers was immediately that you have entered this realm of grandparenthood. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of you throughout this whole book. Is that fair?
Oh, that's very fair. You know, in many ways, I've spent a lot of my professional life working with people much older than me, recording elders, transcribing them, publishing their stories, working with our elders in ceremonies and things like that. So my world has been full of elders. And it's also been full of young people, you know, not only from my own upbringing, but raising 9 children and now in, you know, in the grandfather business. And all of my grandbabies live nearby, and so we see them all the time, speaking to characters who are elders as well as young people is something that I think about and can describe, you know, from my own experience, rather than something I just imagine. And the same thing with, you know, fatherhood and so forth. And, you know, I thought about the fact that life is so much like what happens when we're busy making other plans. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people move to a new, you know, city, state, or what have you, not because they don't value where they just moved from, or the people who were right next to them, sometimes even their closest family members, but because they're seeking, you know, financial opportunity or things like that. And so, you know, a lot of times there's a consequence, an unintended consequence to our movings around and pursuits. And, you know, I think for Byron, who's kind of living the Twin Cities life, in part because of his job, in part because of, you know, his wife's job, she had passed away before the book started, you know, ends up having this consequence of Ezra not getting all of the things that he did when he was a kid. And so he wants to orchestrate that for him and, you know, is trying to find a way. And so, you know, as the drama unfolds, you know, he creates an opportunity for Ezra, but it's also an opportunity for himself to, you know, approach fatherhood in a different way, and an opportunity for Grandpa Liam, the grandfather in the book, to, you know, engage with grandparenting in a whole new level too.
Dr. Anton Troyer-Migwich, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on and asking so many wonderful and thoughtful questions about the work.
That was Dr. Anton Troyer about his latest book, his first novel, Where Wolves Don't Die. Find out more at antontroyer.com. And Troyer is spelled T-R-E-U-E-R. Coming up next on Main Street, Ricky on for Prairie Plates.
I'm Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. To most broadcasters, you are just an eyeball, which they want to monetize. Sounds painful. NPR doesn't want to monetize any of your body parts. We broadcast things we think are interesting or important, or in my case, funny or ridiculous, because we hope you'll feel the same way. We do deep and probing interviews, and we snicker at words like deep and probing. We make the radio we want to hear. This is NPR.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
All right, it's time for Prairie Plates with Rick Guillen. Rick, summer eating, it's the time of year where, you know, sometimes you can just go grab a handful of things that's growing in the garden and just eat it, you know, maybe wipe it on your pants or whatever. Maybe some people wash their food. I don't know. So let's talk about some good, healthy, fun summer foods. And there's some late spring, early summer stuff that you can already be kind of eating. In fact, we're already kind of late for some things like dandelion greens or even yarrow before it blossoms.
Well, you're right. It is a fantastic time of year for food fans. And yes, I'd look for some of those garden items, those early garden items like lettuce and radishes. I like those quite a bit. Some foraging, you can find quite a bit of stuff. Yeah, dandelion greens, some of those things. You're probably a little more expert in those areas. I tend to
I've definitely eaten some questionable things. I don't know if that counts as expert. It's like one of those courage is being scared to do something and doing it anyway, but so is stupidity. It's like, well, am I an expert or am I just taking my chances?
Yeah, I mean, for dandelion greens, you always have to watch if there are dogs in the yard.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
For sure.
So that kind of salad dressing doesn't work. But anyway, garden items, I like to, well, at the grocery store, there's a lot of cherries, nectarines, peaches this time of year. Asian markets, there are a lot of mangoes, lychee, rambutan. We had some of those a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I brought.
Hey, you said mangoes. Have you had the honey mangoes yet?
I don't think so. I've tried about three different kinds. But
I had not even heard of the honey mango before, and then I saw it in a grocery store and grabbed a couple, and then I was like, move over every other mango.
Well,
so, just going to put that out there.
I'll have to look for those because I do like mangoes. They are very good.
So, listen, I know at the end of the harvest season, there are things we can do to sort of preserve food to make it last longer. What about some tips for, you know, when we have this sort of abundance or maybe even a way to eat something because it's just not quite ready? What are some good food techniques that you are employing a little extra this time of year?
I'm a single guy. I live alone, and so I don't can or jar a lot. What I do is freeze, and that's very popular. If you use it within, you know, 3 or 4 months, I wouldn't recommend using it after that. Sometimes that freezer taste gets in. That kind of goes with fresh fish too. I kind of give it about 3 months. Some people with some meat, they give it a year, but to me, it's like a 3 to 6 month span. But
are you doing like the freeze the herbs in the ice cube trays with oil or butter or anything like that?
I freeze mostly tomatoes. I'm a big garden tomato guy. So what I'll do is at the end of the season, I'll take a bunch of tomatoes, whir them up in the food processor and throw them in some larger Ziploc bags and freeze those. And they're very good. The flavor keeps, it's honestly, a lot of times better than jarring tomatoes to me. So, yes, I do a lot of that with tomatoes. Corn also freezes quite well. Green beans freeze quite well. So I do quite a bit of that.
And do you have to do that pretty immediately? I know Sue Balcom was like, listen, if you're going to freeze corn, you're going to do it immediately.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, you can keep corn around on the cob for a week or so, but you know, I like to cut the kernels off blanch it first, cut the kernels off. If you blanch it first, the kernels are easier to cut off.
And blanching is just a quick, like, boil the water, dunk it, and then you're done, right?
Yeah, it's more like simmering water. It's not like a rolling boil. If you're rolling boil of corn, you might make a mess, or I don't know. I just do a kind of a slow simmer and blanch it for, I don't know, 5 minutes, not too long, because you're going to cook it again. And so you don't want to overcook it, I guess. But back to stuff that's good right now, I really like when the cucumbers get going, and that'll be in another few weeks, obviously. I really like Middle Eastern type salads, and I learned how to make this. It's very simple. When I was doing refugee resettlement in the late 90s, and it was some people from the former Yugoslavia, and there's some different iterations with this, but it's like just a mix of tomatoes, cucumbers, and onions or scallions, and they used vinegar and vegetable oil. I like to use olive oil and lemon juice. So it's a little more Greek sort of thing.
Do you do grains like a tabbouleh or a couscous or anything?
Yeah. So you can take that salad, and I just like it as it is, and you can put some green peppers in there. You can do different things, but then you can stick it in with some quinoa or cracked bulgur wheat, whatever your preference is, gluten-free, you know, that sort of thing. And then make a tabbouleh out of it, add a boatload of parsley. You need a boatload.
That is the official official term.
And I like to put some cilantro in there, too.
Ooh, okay.
So, yeah, the tabbouleh with that sort of salad is quite good. And back to the iteration with this cucumber tomato salad, It seems like it's a regional, from Greece to the former Yugoslavia into like Persian areas, where they would make this salad, chop it really fine, actually, and add dried fenugreek leaves.
Oh.
And it has a different flavor.
Nice.
So, yeah, I really like that. And then getting into like cooked foods, I like stir fries on the outdoor griddle, or people like to say Blackstone right away, but there are different versions of outdoor griddles you can purchase. And so garlic, ginger, and a lot of these fresh veggies, you can just stir fry it up with some soy sauce and that sort of thing on the outdoor griddle. And that is excellent. And you don't have that really strong garlic taste or smell in the house, rather.
Do you add things like ginger when you're doing your stir fries?
I like heavy ginger. It's not only is it healthy, it's flavorful. So I really enjoy ginger. Obviously, a lot of garlic. I mean, if you're going to do a big batch of it, I'd probably put 7 or 8 garlic cloves chopped up in there and really make it garlicky. You can put hot pepper paste in there, different chilies, spice it up a little bit. I do like to use noodles. So if you use like lo mein noodles, or you can use rice noodles. I wouldn't boil them. I would soak them first and then add the sauce in. But you can do that with rice noodles, too, and make like a pad thai sort of thing. Or bean thread glass noodles are really good. And again, I'd soak those first instead of boiling them, because those noodles and rice noodles, if you boil them first and then stir fry them, they get extremely gummy. So you want to just soak them in some kind of lukewarm water for about an hour.
Well, and in this kind of cooking, sauces is really where it's at. What are some combinations of oils and vinegars and fish sauces and whatever that you like using? Or even, I feel like I see peanut a lot of times.
Yeah, with pad thai, it's going to be heavy, heavy tamarind. And you can buy tamarind paste at the Asian market. What I like is to buy a box of the tamarind pods, and they're kind of fun. And I'll shell them, and then I soak them for a couple hours and then get all the tamarind paste. And they kind of taste like a raisin a little bit. I know they're kind of weird. If you go and look at them, you'll be like, wow, this is interesting. But the flavor from fresh tamarind is like no other. It's got kind of this sweet, bitter sort of thing going on, sour. And so for pad thai, you want to use a lot of tamarind, lime juice, that sort of thing, crushed peanuts on top. Some people will put some peanut butter in the pad thai sauce, but I tend to just do the crushed peanuts, but yeah, there's a little fish sauce in there too. For yakisoba, that's going to be more of a sweet soy. You'd use your ginger, garlic, and then soy sauce with maybe a little water in it just to break it up a little bit. And then I put some sake in there, some sugar. So, yeah, sweet soy for the yakisoba. And yakisoba noodles, you don't even need to boil.
Yeah.
They just kind of come from the Asian market, and you can put the sauce on the flat top and then get them going. So it's really an interesting thing.
Are you making your sauces fresh every time, or do you make a few and then kind of intermix?
No, I make them fresh. You have to.
Look at you.
Yeah.
All right. We check in with Ricky on once a week. Anybody with suggestions or questions, send them to plates@prairiepublic.org. Rick, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 18th. The Dakota Territory Legislature created Richland County on January 4th, 1873. It was named for Morgan T. Rich. In 1869, Rich settled on the site of what would become the city of Wahpeton. Wahpeton serves as the county seat of Richland County, tucked along the Red River in the southeastern corner of North Dakota. There were several bonanza farms in the county, including the Bag Farm that today is a historical site. With convenient access to the Red River for transportation and containing vast tracts of rich farmland, Richland County grew rapidly. In 1886, Horace Crandall compiled a history of the county. He described people who settled there as that class of persons who have the ambition to go and get to the front, using their combined labors to erect cities, putting them on the great highway of prosperity. As the county grew, it became apparent that a proper courthouse was needed. Plans were made to build what county officials proclaimed would be the finest courthouse in North Dakota. The construction got off to a rough start. When the contractor was placing a cornerstone, the derrick tipped over. The boom hit him and knocked him down, but he escaped serious injury. The unfortunate accident was followed by a legal objection to the construction. Wahpeton had been chosen as the site of the new courthouse, but residents of Morton brought a lawsuit to stop the work until a special election could be held to choose the site of the county seat. When they were not able to prove the fraud that they alleged, Judge Allen dismissed the suit. In November 1913, the courthouse was complete. County employees began moving in, and planning began for the dedication. Everyone in Richland County would be invited. On this date, in 1914, it was reported that the courthouse dedication had been a roaring success. Large crowds attended the program and wandered through the new building. 1,000 attendees partook of a lunch provided by members of the community. Perhaps the best news of all was that city officials had put money aside in a building fund, meaning the new courthouse was debt-free as it opened. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow, Main Street is preempted for a special on Juneteenth, a federal holiday commemorating the end of slavery. We'll air a special episode of No Small Endeavor as it explores many issues still facing race relations today. We hear from Fred Gray as he discusses working as Martin Luther King's lawyer during the Montgomery bus boycott. Willie James Jennings describes the religious and cultural origins of racism. And the late James Lawson, the architect of the civil rights movement, explains how he and other leaders came to believe that the only way to effectively desegregate the nation was through non nonviolent protest. A special episode during this time slot tomorrow commemorating Juneteenth. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.